Well, that, yeah. Okay. We're juggling things right before we go live. It's so much out there now. It's just crazy. I think one of the most important things we've always tried to get across without going overboard with it, there's no gain in that. We don't put people down, but we do call it as we see it. And we're not perfect, but we're pretty damn good at seeing through artifice, deception, deceit, misdirection, and outright lies. And we have named a few names in the past, and we no need to do it again. But these are people you really want to take very carefully with several grains of salt every time you encounter them. They have their own agendas. Some of them are being paid, I have no doubt, or have made other arrangements, not necessarily remuneration arrangements, but they've made arrangements. This whole thing is being run. It's controlled. These aren't just Paul Revere's riding onto the scene and getting a huge platform all of a sudden. It doesn't work that way. They're put up there for a reason. Now, one of the recent fellows that we did talk about, oh, there's a nice-looking young woman sitting here. Hello, what are you doing?
Hello. Yes, I'm waiting for my cue.
Cue. I don't do QAnon. I told you that.
That's good.
All right. There are people out there who still buy into that loopy stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever. It's a free country. One of the people that we mentioned was Dr. John Campbell. And for those of you who don't know, he's not an MD. He's not a medical doctor. He's apparently got a PhD in something. And so he goes by Dr. John Campbell. And we did have what appeared to be a video that was sort of a CV. He was kind of like pitching himself to somebody. It was a strange thing. I'm not sure how it got posted, but it's up there. Now, Dr. John Campbell has developed a fairly substantial following. He was very much pro-bioweapon injection in the beginning, but then did a 180 on that. I've heard this from a number of people. So he's another one. He's a kind of a fatherly figure, nice fellow, humble, perfect package to do all kinds of things with if you wanted to. But he's just another one, and again, I'm not picking on John. He's probably a wonderful guy. I don't know. But you must be careful in the alt-news world. Don't grab on to things. Do you remember back in the day when Beef Stew was pushing Dr. Artis and don't turn on your kitchen tap? There's King Cobra snake venom and crate venom in there. It's going to come right out in your drinking glass. That's what they were saying. They actually produced a documentary about that. Lunatic stuff. And they haven't completely gone away from the venom aspect of it, because apparently on the spike there are two or three positions for venom DNA or components thereof. I can't remember precisely what it was, but they got lucky and that showed up and they hung their hat on that. But they're still at it. Another one is nicotine. Nicotine is going to really save the day. No, it's not. No. You'll feel better. If you smoke, you know, when you take your first couple of puffs, you feel better. That's the nicotine going into your blood. Makes you feel better. It's like amphetamine. But as far as a reversing tool for genetic catastrophic damage to your body, forget it. No. But that's what they do. They hang solutions out there and wait for the moths to show up to the flame. It's just the way it works. All right. Anything else you want to add to that? And then I'll mention Michael Yon here.
No, it's true. The media was relied upon to perpetuate much of this fraud. And that involved identifying and selecting influencers in social media, on YouTube, And I don't know if these people actually auditioned for these roles. But you can find quite a few of them that were virtual nobodies prior to the pandemic, and then I guess were offered an opportunity to go big, and they took it, and they pushed a script. They pushed a narrative. And the narrative was that there's a virus out there that you need to be afraid of, and sit tight and wear your mask and stay home and wait for a vaccine. And when the vaccine became available, boy, did they push it. And they ought to be ashamed of themselves. You know, and
over
some of these people
took it.
Some of these people were medical professionals, you know, credentialed medical professionals that, you know, really should have known better. And, you know, if the average Joe on the street can figure it out, some of them anyway, you know, a bona fide medical professional should have known. And yet
they never erred on the side of caution. None of them. They pushed it.
And they pushed
it. I'll never forget
that. Safe
and
effective.
Sickening.
And now a lot of them have backpedaled on what they said initially and doing their mea culpas and, oh, well, we really didn't mean it or we didn't know or, you know, it's every excuse in the book.
Right.
And they're still out there. So, go ahead with Michael Yon's latest.
Oh, just one quickie. Beef Stew is the classic example. Well, there are others, but he's a classic example of somebody with virtually no background in this business at all, coming out of nowhere and landing in a big platform, overnight practically. The most I could ever find is that there was a claim that he did something in the neighborhood of 30 or 40 podcasts with some big large guy named Richard Leonard. And that was the totality of his experience. You think of the probably hundreds of thousands of people who were far more qualified to get that slot. Why him? How did that happen? Those are questions we'll never have the answers to. How do these people show up overnight out of nowhere and all of a sudden get traction? And they're all over the alt news world on every podcast and green screeners wet dream you can think of, and there they are. Michael Yon, he said, people like this must not be trusted. He's talking about Dr. John Campbell. And I don't want you to write here. This is Michael Yon, his opinion. And he is eminently qualified to have an opinion like this because of his background, his intelligence, and his research. Again, he says, people like this must not be trusted. He pushed the jab back when it mattered most. And then, anyway, that's what he said. What else did he say? Anything? That was pretty much it.
Well, not surprisingly, a lot of people, fans of John Campbell, took issue with that. You know, they were quick to defend him.
Right.
And one person says at the start he was pushing it like everybody else. Then, after analyzing the stats, he figured out that something was wrong. He then changed his tune afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael says to that, correctly so, no, not like everybody else. I and millions more said no from the start. That's true.
Fair enough.
You know, and
totally
you can put
true.
A lot of other people in that same basket as John Campbell, but...
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. I had two videos of him urging people to roll up their sleeves, so to speak, in the beginning. And then when he, I guess, was contacted, this is all, remember, he didn't do this by himself, to run as an indie for president, he had to switch. Now, Trump didn't switch and is still pushing the death shots. And he's not going to change. I'm surprised he didn't back off.
Well, he really, you know, he obviously thinks we're all stupid.
Oh, you bet. Yeah. So RFK Jr. is no knight in shining armor. He has at least been on Epstein's jet twice. And that's what we know about. So These people are compromised. Understand, the control over the individual and therefore the masses is a past art for those who have the power and money to own the medium. And the medium is owned by them. They own the media.
That's right.
All right. Now, just go slow. If you have an inner feeling that something isn't right with somebody, don't dismiss that. Look at it, consider it, and understand that a lot of people are saying things that benefit them in a major way. I'll be polite. So there. Now, there's so many we could name. It just doesn't serve any purpose. It sounds like sour grapes or something, people.
It does. It does.
The thing is,
much of the information is good. You know, it has
correct.
To be
that's
in,
how
in
they,
order
that's
for them
how they
to
play
maintain
the game.
Their credibility.
Of course. Yeah. It's called street credentials. That's what it's called.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to be right or truthful at least some of the time, and they are. But the thing is, you know, you've really got to be discriminating to be able to determine when they're not being truthful.
I'm thinking about that. That's very hard to do for most people. They don't have the interest, they don't have the ability to synthesize all the data that we try to put together so you have a chance of really grasping it. You're busy. Most of you are busy. You've got lives, you've got problems, you've got vax-injured people, you're afraid, you've got... That's all true. So we try to make it in an accessible, approachable format so you can grab it, look at it, and make your own decision. We don't want you to think like we do necessarily at all. It's up to you. So...
Yeah.
Exercise that while you still can. All right, here we have an OBGYN, GYN, registered nurse, Michelle Gershman, G-E-R-S-H-M-A-N. We've featured her before, and she has a few things to say about... Go ahead.
Well, this was a big round table, many, many different people here, many of whom I'm not familiar with, but she was the ringleader for this, and it was an international get-together, and they were all comparing notes about, you know, what's going on in the hospitals, sharing experiences, and it was interesting. Somebody asked her, are things better now than they were in 2021 in terms of fetal demise, stillbirths, mm-hmm. you know, complicated pregnancies. Right. And, we'll let her answer.
Michelle Gershman.
And I'm not sure if you folks have heard about that or not. So
what you're seeing on the ward now is the same as it in 2021 was compared.
Yes, it is. And actually, it's worse. The babies, the fetal demises are about the same. I told somebody on the last show that I spoke on about a month ago that it seemed to be getting a little bit better. We seem to have a little bit less fetal demises. And then I went to work the next...
Whoop. Hold on. Something happened to the audio here. Darn it. Come on, Michelle. Say something. All right, I'm going to have to back this up and restart it. I can see that now. Something weird happened. All right, I'm going to restart it. Reload. So what she just said is important. She thought things were getting a little better, but upon taking another look, they're not. It's not at all, unfortunately, getting better. All right, I got 10 seconds here. Anything you want to pop in here?
No, she should she can say it better than I can. But that's you know, disappointing.
Yeah. Let's see what's going on here. I have no audio now. Let me go check up here. This has happened before. It's almost like somebody throws a little switch. And if you look under System Preferences, which I learned to do, and you look under Sound, it says, ah, it did it again. It's muted. Somebody muted it. I didn't mute it. So I'm going to unmute it, and here we go.
I put my foot in my mouth. I was like, okay, I can't say things are getting better, because that was like a slap in the face. And so I was just being hopeful that day, and then I was reminded, no, it's not better. It's the same. And then the moms are sicker than ever. We have 19-year-olds with heart issues, blood pressure issues, strokes, neurological issues, all kinds of crazy stuff. You know, women that aren't even, they're still in their teens. And so it's the same. 2021 was horrible. We saw carnage, and it's still happening.
Is it fair to say that this is not only a war, it's a war against many things, but it's certainly a war against human reproduction, and it's certainly a war against women?
Yeah.
I think that's a fair statement. Women
no
are
question.
Just paying a horrible price. Now we're finding out that men are too, but it's just not as dramatic. You
right.
don't hear about it as often. But
yep.
This is a war on human reproduction, and it is an existential threat to the continued existence of human beings. Human beings are in trouble. Big.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Mom.
Yeah.
So Jessica Richards is next.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody. And hi, Michelle. And thanks for that incredible presentation. I'm really sorry for what you've been through. And, you know, really grateful for what you're doing about it, and all power to you. I've got a practical question to ask, and I'm glad you got the youth as well, so you're going to live long enough to see this through. I'm going to keep living out of spite just to get them. But a practical question to ask you, because although we're in different countries, it seems that this practice is going on all over the world. So they're all doing the same thing in the hospitals. There's slight variations with it. It's basically they're still just murdering and abusing people in the hospitals. What I wanted to ask, we don't always have a choice. Sometimes, like your poor mother and her partner, we have to go to hospital, same as my sister. We don't have a choice. We have to go to a hospital because we need something we cannot get elsewhere, and we might need surgery or oxygen or something like that. What's your advice, given the experience that you've had now, to best protect ourselves and our loved ones from being basically murdered, especially those of us over a certain age when it's pretty much a sure bet, you know?
Well, first of all, I would say to have an advocate with you, a family member, somebody who can watch what they're putting in your IVs.
And as we've said, we did a program, three, four programs ago, I don't remember now, about the death protocols in the hospitals. Nurse Anne has backed that up many times. And the time to decide on an advocate is now. Don't wait. Sit down with the family or friends and decide who's going to advocate for whom if someone has to go to a hospital. That's really a smart thing to do. It wouldn't take very long. And then that person, whoever the advocate is for you, needs to be somewhat up to speed on this whole mess. All they have to do is listen to four or five of our programs, and they'll get the picture. It's right there.
And it's so hard to say because I believe most pharmaceuticals are toxic. So I have a hard time. Like if somebody's giving a new medication, I would want to know what it's for and the side effects and everything. And so there are resources outside of the hospital that you could call, like Dr. Thorpe. He's on this call. I know he works for a wellness company. And so I'm sure that he's a great resource for like different medications that would help. And then there's also Nurses Out Loud, which is like a remote resource that you can always ask them questions. There's another woman named Gail Seiler, and she's part of a corporation that's CHCMP. She's advocating for patients who have been given remdesivir or had the protocol unleashed on them. So it's these resources that you could call, and then they know people that can advocate for you. But I'm afraid to go to the hospital myself or to have a family member in the hospital. And then like, one of the first people who talked, who spoke, I'm not sure which one, Peter, how he said that he was in the hospital about 10 years ago and he had a great experience. I'm sure that there's still good nurses out there, good doctors out there.
Well, she said the most important thing, 10 years ago. That's 5 years, 6 years almost, before this horrible genocide began. And certainly there were hospitals that had reasonable protocols, outstanding doctors. And then when they started this death game, they mandated that every professional healthcare worker in America take the shot. One third of them said, go to hell and quit. So that left two thirds in charge. And they've raised the number of employees since, professional healthcare employees. But generally speaking, when those people walked, all those left behind working in hospitals were injected. So what's their agenda? What are they going to do? How are they going to be counted on to advocate for anybody in an objective manner? I don't see it.
And if I believe if you are unleashed with the protocol, then you really need help. And I think not all cases end up like that.
No.
Okay, that's about enough for that. Did we get it all in there?
Yeah, that's plenty. Okay. But it's a long, long interview. And like I said, there's probably 12 different people on there just contributing.
Oh, they keep switching people on the screen. It's six up, and they keep moving them around. So a lot of people. Anyway, that's just a little look. This is a professional OBGYN, RN, and she's seeing frightful things. So frightful that you just heard her. She says, I don't want anything to do with going to a hospital. And words to the wise. Okay.
Well, and she did go on to say that, then they both agreed that some hospitals are clearly worse than others. You know, there are still good doctors and nurses. They may be few and far between, but they are out there. And it's really a roll of the dice, you know, if you get lucky or not.
Well, if your hospital has a large pile of black plastic bags behind it, you probably don't want to go there.
You know, I've said this before. It seems as though the smaller community hospitals might be a better bet than going to one of these large corporate facilities. You know, the smaller community hospitals tend to be a part of those conglomerates.
Right.
But nevertheless, being smaller, maybe you'll get a better shot at not being abused.
Well, you'd hope. But the little ones, just like the local funeral homes, have all been bought up by national chains.
Yeah, that's what I said. Yeah, I know.
So
but
you're
still.
Right. And then that's, God, my cute little hospital and our cute little town, which is owned by some multi-billion dollar conglomerate. And
right.
So it will be staffed and operated on the bases that conglomerate wants to exert on you. Not a fun thing. We've spent a lot of time, Erica has, trying to explain the iron issue, which is very important now. But there's something that is even more important, and that's the copper issue in the human body. There are people out there now who think that they need to take more copper, and more iron. You know, we've got those bag bars, and people are going in and getting a bag of iron in an IV drip, and I don't know what it costs, but I wouldn't be surprised if they're not doing the same thing with copper. Let's try and lay this copper issue out. It's an important one. It's a little bit complicated, not too terribly bad. I'll play a little bit of a video about it here, then we'll come back and have Erica bring it into focus. All right, here we go. How does copper drive cancer progression?
When this tumor mass needs a blood supply and signals to the capillary to bud and bring a blood vessel to the tumor, blood supply, nutrients, oxygen.
Got it? That's how cancer takes over your body and co-opts it. It signals for a blood supply, and the body cooperates, gives it all the nutrition, all the oxygen, everything it might want in your blood supply. That's called a vascularized tumor.
That's angiogenesis.
And that is called, just so you know, angiogenesis. Right? The
right.
Administering of the
means...
blood supply. Go ahead.
Yeah, angiogenesis just means creating new blood vessels. And that's, I'll let the video roll and then we can talk about it.
That's angiogenesis. That's a copper-dependent process. You will see the tumor signals the liver to release copper from the storage molecule ceruloplasmin. And you will see ceruloplasmin and copper go up in the serum. And this is a sign that angiogenesis is happening. Remember that ceruloplasmin is also an acute phase reactant in inflammation, so you have to take everything in context. If they also have an infection, maybe that's why their ceruloplasmin is high. So these are not cancer markers. These are physiologic biomarkers. So you have to take everything in context and say, what does it mean? But if you see this constellation of all these factors that I'm bringing to your attention today make a pattern, then you think cancer. So angiogenesis, of course, is a normal process. We want angiogenesis. You have surgery, you have an accident, you need to bring blood vessels into the injured area and repair that incision or that injury. So we don't want zero angiogenesis. Angiogenesis is not pathologic inherently. So the fact of cancer is that tumor cells co-opt our normal physiologic processes to accomplish their goals and needs. And so they're not making up new physiology, they're just taking as hostage our normal processes. So this initiation of angiogenesis is one of the steps of disease progression and acceleration. So creating an environment where this is contained is very powerful. And we actually do this in stage 3 and 4 cancer patients where angiogenesis and metastasis has already occurred. So stage 1 is when you have primarily local disease. Stage 2 is when you have invasion of the lymph nodes. Stage 3 and 4 when you get progression to other sites in the body, and there is no stage 5. So usually in stage 3 and 4 patients, oncologists also are running out of ideas. And so we want to say, okay, how can we contain the disease without toxicity? So controlling copper and thereby controlling angiogenesis is a mechanism. So this is what happens. You have this tumor cell developing in isolation in the tissue, and it all of a sudden it gets hypoxic because it's replicated to the point where the center is not getting any nutrients or any oxygen. A smaller cell will just have membrane access to the environment, to nutrients, to oxygen.
Okay, so she's showing a chart here, which you can't see. Imagine 3 marbles, smallest on the left, a little larger, and then the largest one on the right. The smallest one on the left is what she's talking about. That's a tumor. And through its membrane, it's accessing blood, nutrients, whatever it needs. It's not yet hooked up by means of angiogenesis to your blood supply. That's the first stage. So she's going to go on from there.
Just like a little single-celled organism. As it gets bigger, it needs more nutrients to grow. So it sends a signal out to the capillary, and the capillaries start to move towards the tumor, and boom, you got a blood supply, and now you can grow. That's what happens.
The middle marble now has little tendrils, little capillaries coming from a blood vessel over to that marble, beginning to hook up to it, giving it basically like you pull into a gas station, you get a fill-up. This is a constant fill-up with nutrition, oxygen, and whatever else it needs.
So in that context, once you have a tumor cell with a good blood supply, then the specialized metastatic cells in that mass, some of them have enzymes that can break through the blood vessel wall, can break through into the extracellular matrix, then break through into another larger blood vessel and travel. And then when they get to a nice place, they're a new neighborhood, they want to have a new condominium, then they do the same thing in reverse and start growing there. And so we want to inhibit this process. The places where metastasis is most common are the highly vascular areas of the body, where there's more blood vessels. And no one ever dies of a primary tumor for the most part. It is metastatic disease that kills cancer patients.
So there's an argument to scan, to monitor, to watch for the earliest stages of cancer, which often, again, present no pain, no overt symptoms. It's tough. So if you can catch it early, before it becomes hooked up to your blood supply, vascularized, you got a much better chance. Once it's hooked up, it grows and it starts throwing out these metastatic impulses throughout all the body. It goes anywhere. It basically can go in the bloodstream and I think be transported anywhere.
Mm-hmm. So if we can really contain that and prevent a major organ from being taken over by a tumor mass and thereby damaging important functions. So if you lose liver function, lung capacity, if your brain is filled with metastatic lesions, you know, you're in trouble. You're going to lose important function that allows you to live. So
That's really important and worth repeating. Once that tumor is hooked up to the blood supply and begins to gorge itself on your nutrition and oxygen that comes through your blood system and begins to throw off these metastatic, what would you call them? Little packages?
Seedlings.
Right, whatever. The point is, you can go in and you can cut that tumor out, but it's already in your entire vascular system.
Mm.
It's all around your body, looking for a place to set up shop. So, not easy, not fun. And most people know next to nothing about cancer like that, unless they end up with it.
You could have a breast cancer patient who gets metastasis to the brain or metastasis to the bone or to the liver. And once those organs are taken over, then it's not possible to sustain life. So again, the more we can contain tumor progression, travel, and just size, patients can live with metastatic disease for quite a long time if we can control it. So inhibiting copper's impact on angiogenesis is a mechanism for doing that. Okay, and so there are really, really a lot of studies now. We've been doing oral copper chelation, reducing copper levels for decades in naturopathic medicine, but there were some studies that came out in about the last 5 years. There was a.
All right, I'm going to pause it there. That's Dr. Nalini. N-A-L-I-N-I, or Natalie, I don't know what it is. Looks like Nalini to me. Chilkov. So that's very good, and I hope that was helpful. It was a pretty simple way to look at it, but it's not a very complicated issue early on. If you can get it before it becomes vascularized and gorging on your body and throwing out metastases, you got a good chance. Otherwise, it can be almost anywhere. All right, copper.
Well, and she goes on to explain that she cites a particular case where there was a woman with stage 4 metastatic breast cancer, triple negative, mm-hmm. Which means it's not hormone responsive, that was on this chelation, copper chelation protocol, and, you know, it's still alive now, and I think it's been, if you listen to the video, 4 or 5 years and doing fine. I mean, I bring this up because I know there's a lot of people that have jumped on the copper bandwagon now. There's several influencers out there that are promoting it, saying that it's, you know, the key to getting your ferritin levels up. It's more complicated than that. Yes, you need copper in order to regulate your iron metabolism. But by the same token, you don't want to develop copper toxicity. And I think, I mean, I know that that's happening with a lot of people right now because of this spike protein, the way it affects copper metabolism.
Right.
There are people developing copper toxicity. We know that because of they're developing the Kaiser-Fleischer rings around their eyes, in the, around the iris. You can see that with a slit lamp if you have an ophthalmological exam.
Right.
And copper can really destroy the liver. And as I said the other night, doing a simple blood test is not going to give you a full picture of what's really happening with copper in your body. The blood may very well be low. It may show low copper. It may show low ceruloplasm. But with this particular infection, because there's so much inflammation involved, what's happening is that the copper is not staying bound to the ceruloplasmin. And so you've got a similar problem with iron. When it dissociates from its carrier protein, you have a reactive metal that's permeating your body and creating horrendous oxidative stress. And if cancer has formed and it has access to this copper, that could be one reason why we're seeing an explosion of cancer, because of this copper dysregulation and iron dysregulation. Those are metals that tumors can use to fuel their growth and establish a blood supply. For anyone that's dealing with cancer, I would consider the copper aspect of it, that this copper chelation is a viable therapy. And the compound that they're using is something called ammonium tetrathiomolybdate. So it's a sulfated version of molybdenum. And molybdenum is an element that's antagonistic to copper. So just be very, very careful with copper. It demands a lot of respect. And women in particular, as I said the other night, tend to have too much copper. And the sad thing is that it's often in a bio-unavailable form. They've got tons of it, but they cannot use it because either they don't have the ceruloplasmin to transport it properly, and it's stored in tissues. So they can be both very toxic with it and deficient at the same time. They'll have a functional deficiency of copper, and that can result in anemia because copper will interfere with the formation of heme and the iron sulfur complexes that are needed to create heme. It's a real quandary, and I would not be casual about if you're a woman supplementing with copper. In fact, I know of a few cases, there may be more because they tend to be hidden, of women that were doing one of the protocols trying desperately to get their ferritin levels up by working on their ceruloplasmin, taking copper and vitamin A, and they did end up in the hospital with liver failure. So just be aware of that. It's a complicated topic, and you really have to assess what you're dealing with before you make assumptions about whether you need to take copper or get rid of it.
And how many doctors are fluent in their knowledge about this subject? Honestly, right now, if you go to your GP or...
Oh, none.
Or almost
none,
any.
None.
That's the point. You've got nowhere to go. You really have to do your own research, and we try and make that available to you. So hang on to these programs. It's very important. You've got several readers about iron not helping. It kind of ties into this a little bit. If you want to do... do those. Why don't you go ahead? It's our last batch, June 28th.
June 30th, was it?
28th.
28th, okay.
Right in the middle almost. Iron not helping. There's two there.
Yeah, okay.
Go ahead.
I got
take
it.
Take both of those. Go ahead.
All right. This is a woman, obviously. To all my heavy period bleeders who have upped your ferritin one way or another to the optimal level, are some of you still bleeding heavily? And 55 comments, mostly yes. So fixating on just ferritin to try to solve, you know, whatever issues. A lot of these people are anemic. That's what they're in the group for.
Ferritin is?
Just ferritin is the storage form of iron. And it is something that can be measured in the blood, and they like to see it at a certain level. And you can infer from that level approximately how much you have in the rest of your body. Both of these metals are very difficult to determine. What are the actual tissue levels? Because what's in the blood is not representative necessarily of what's in the tissues. You can have very low levels of these metals in your blood and have extremely high levels in the liver, the brain, the kidneys, the heart. With copper, it's generally the liver and the brain, and then maybe to some extent the kidneys. Copper toxicity can manifest as Parkinson's. And we have, you know,
oh,
a plethora
how interesting.
Of people now.
Wait. You just opened the door to misdiagnosis of Parkinson's, didn't you?
Well, yeah. We have a lot of people with these movement disorders that are being assumed to have Parkinson's, but have they been adequately evaluated for copper toxicity?
Very interesting.
And, you know, it can manifest as tremors. Ataxia, personality changes. And the fact that the spike protein does have several binding sites on it, actually, it can accept copper.
They didn't get there accidentally either, friends. They were put there.
Well, we call it a magnetoprotein. It will attract metals. It has the cysteine. Cysteine is a form of sulfur. Cysteine residues on it that will attract something like copper. Copper loves sulfur. Loves sulfur. So if you've got sulfur around and here comes the spike, well, it's looking as though the spike can acquire that copper, steal it. Especially if it's been dissociated from its carrier. It's free. So the spike picks it up and redistributes it around the body. Wherever the spike goes, it can bring this copper with it. And wreak havoc, because it will generate free radicals. You know, copper can accept oxygen. All right, we got another one.
I didn't know that. Copper can grab oxygen molecules, too.
Yeah, just like iron.
Oh, how interesting.
Yeah.
All right.
Yep.
Very good. Okay, go ahead.
All right, this is a second case. And this, I bring it up just to illustrate how complicated this issues with iron and copper is.
Mm-hmm.
This person says, I wish I had known 6 months ago that copper can play such a huge role in iron deficiency. After over a year of wondering why supplements and even iron infusions don't work for me, click my name in the group for updates on my journey, I finally found out the iron deficiency is just a symptom of a bigger problem. It's a relief and a nightmare at the same time. I have copper toxicity. It's chronic heavy metal poisoning, basically. Too much or too little copper prevents iron from absorbing. If you have any of the following, ask your doctor to check your serum copper ASAP. 1, persistent or severe iron issues that don't resolve with supplementation. 2, unexplained low ferritin, no clear cause even after investigating. 3, neurological symptoms in addition to low ferritin, migraines, nerve pain, extreme brain fog or confusion, inability to think of common words, new onset severe trouble concentrating. 4, new onset severe depression, anxiety, mental illness, along with low ferritin. 5, shaking, involuntary twitching or tremors. 6, persistent nausea and GI issues, along with fatigue and low ferritin. I put a list of common symptoms in the photos, and she has a picture of her legs in this photo that she's attached, and she's covered in bruises.
She's sitting in the bed up on a pillow, holding a camera in front of her, taking a photo of her legs from the thighs on down to the knees. And on each thigh, especially the left, are round bruises. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12 on the left, 2, 3 on the right at least. And they're just like bruises. That's what they are, bruises.
Yeah, well, so that's another hallmark of copper toxicity is easy bruising. And as I mentioned the other night, you know, this crazy menstrual bleeding where, you know, you'll bleed for 3 months, 3 weeks out of the month with heavy clotting, you know, similar to what we were seeing and still are seeing to some degree with the bioweapon. And I think it's highly conceivable that this bleeding issue is associated with this copper dysregulation. So in the comment section of this, the 556 comments, somebody nailed her to you know, what did you do to resolve this?
Right.
And she had been using a estrogen patch, a birth control estrogen patch, and when she got rid of the patch, this situation resolved. And why? Because estrogen causes the retention of copper. And that's why women are very prone to copper overload.
Very interesting. Well, again, you could go to 100 doctors and they probably wouldn't be able to explain what you just heard explained. They just don't.
I mean, people suffer for years with these, you know, these mystery conditions that they just can't figure out. And, you know, a lot of times it's having to do with the regulating these metals.
Unreal.
And the hormones, you know, do affect copper.
Okay, very important information there. There's another group here, recovery relapse. It's right down below that. You see that?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right, let's see what we got here. I need help. Vax injured, almost died, left with painful occipital neuralgia and trigeminal.
Trigeminal.
All right, neuralgia. Thought it was getting better, but now getting worse and worse. Last Pfizer vax, February 2022, I wanted to die when I was incoherent for almost a year. Now the pain is so bad, I have no one to help me. I wish it had killed me, living in hell and homeless. Any suggestions? And one response, don't give up. Look up doctors affiliated with the FLCCC. The truth is finally starting to come out, and there is treatment. Don't know about that, but that's what the comment says. Another one asks, what is FLCCC? So, okay.
Yeah, that's the original poster that said that. Well, you didn't even know.
Never heard of it. Crazy. Okay. Go ahead. Number two there.
You're not alone on this frightening ride. I just spent another sleepless night awake, alone, and scared out of my mind. Life as I knew it is in ashes. I was also incoherent for almost 2 years. I can't say what my future holds. I hope it helps to know you're understood in this group. And this group is what helped me to still be here through this pure anguish. I'm currently trying to reframe this in my mind, even though everyone who said they loved me has turned their back and ran. But I am still here. I have to be here for me. Hopefully soon I can hold my head up and look back and know I am a survivor that got somewhere safe and fought for me when no one else would. I hope this helps. It sounds corny, but we have to be our own heroes and fight and believe we are worth it. You are not alone. Another one chimes in. I was on the emergency line today with both hands on my heart and going left and right in a dark room, unable to walk. I asked to go to emergency, but I can't due to my brain symptoms. The hospitals are not equipped to deal with these cases. I declined and I said I'll do my home care. I'm okay, but I'm not okay at all. My health condition is unprecedented and unknown. I'm getting worse, as well as nothing I can do. I've been for 3 days. We need more studies. I totally believe we have a new form of autoimmune disease. It's not normal, and all these protocols you see online are hit or miss, and we need to sit tight and wait.
And there's one more. This is under a topic called recovery relapse. I hear you, says another. I see you. I had occipital, trigeminal, and pudendal hell. I could barely hold up my head or use my arms. What saved me was methylene blue. It saved me in about 20 minutes. Some people think it could be dangerous, but you know the pain, so I'm sure you understand. I didn't care. I didn't figure it could make anything worse. It was amazing. It took 10 drops a day for 10 weeks. I don't have any of that pain anymore, aside from an occasional worrisome twinge that doesn't last. And someone says to that, I'm so sorry. I have ON also. I can't imagine having TN as well. And a third, microdosing capsules really helped relieve my anxiety, severe pain, and arthritis. I have been coping well since I started microdosing. I usually get the capsules from blah, blah, blah on Instagram, etc. Okay. So, methylene blue, real quick. Your thoughts?
I don't have any first-hand experience with it, but I know it has helped some people. I mean, it's a redox modulator, so when you're in a situation where the cell is hypoxic and you're building up a lot of oxidative stress, this thing will even it out because you need something that can gain and lose electrons to save the cell, basically. I mean, they do use it for carbon monoxide poisoning and what's the other one? Cyanide poisoning. So it's in a situation where the cell has been deprived of oxygen, it'll keep the cell from dying, basically.
Got it. All right, last little quickie here. Shedding is real. I used to be just like you, thinking it was all BS, until I had a sexual encounter with a condom with someone who had taken the shot. I had symptoms that lasted for almost 3 weeks, and I knew it was real ever since. And no, it wasn't an STD either. I don't get much shedding symptoms when I'm just simply around the vax, except for headaches. However, some get violently ill just from that. We all react differently, and just because you may not doesn't make it untrue. Some get it hard, some get it less hard, but it's real nonetheless. So again, some people can get out there and be around the vaxxed and not show anything overtly for a while, but eventually it will catch up and manifest in some obvious physical symptomology. This is no way to beat it. It happens. This is a terrible thing that's been done to us. All right, anything
yeah.
we missed?
No.
Okay. You have a good weekend, and thank you.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. Okay, you too. Good night, everyone.
We will be back with another hour for you coming up next.